This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. It's not enough anymore to throw on a pair of sweats and a pair of old sneakers and go for a jog and forget about a regular old running race. These days, anyone who's anyone seems to be running obstacle races. From the Tough Mudder to the Death Race to the Spartan Race, races where your knees see as much dirt as your feet are all the rage. The Spartan Race was actually started by a Vermonter. The first race in 2010 was relatively small, a couple hundred people. But this year, hundreds of thousands of people will sign up and run these courses across the country and internationally in places like Mexico, Slovakia, Australia, France, and South Africa. In addition, six of the races are being televised this year on NBC Sports. Here's a clip from a Spartan race held this summer in Pemberton, Pennsylvania.
They say if it doesn't challenge you, then it sure as hell won't change you. For the thousands of racers that have been knocked around by this relentless Blue Mountain course, relief is in sight. The finish line on the horizon. With four obstacles and a half mile to go, the elite men are nearing the journey's end. John Yatsko has maintained a small lead since mile three, but Bracken Cracker and Bear Novakovic refused to give up.
Refusing to give up is sort of a hallmark of these athletes and of the Spartan Race founder, Joe DeSena. He joins me today to talk a little bit about what he sees as the motivation behind this kind of endurance event and why he thinks it's about more than just a fitness challenge. Joe DeSena, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thanks for having me.
So the World Championship Spartan Race is this weekend in Killington. You must be in the home stretch, and I imagine you're kind of exhausted getting ready for this, but what's it going to be like this weekend?
Oh, it's going to be awesome. There's 10,000 plus athletes. There's at least 3,000 or 4,000 spectators. NBC is going to be there. And yes, we are pulling our hair out of our heads at this point.
Well, thank you for being willing to sit down and talk with us for a couple minutes at least. So for people who aren't familiar with this kind of racing, and I don't know who isn't at this point because they're everywhere, but can you describe what it's like? I mean, how it's different from, say, a steeplechase?
Well, I mean, there's obstacles in steeplechase, but there's so many obstacles, and it's so natural, the environment with hills and mud and many cases rain. I mean, this past weekend, as an example, in Southern California, we had 105-106 degree temperatures clocked. So you're really out there, and you're pushing your limits in so many ways, and the obstacles become metaphors for life. And when you get through a Spartan race, what we found, and we'll have almost 1 million participants this year, in talking to all these people, is that life becomes easier. When you push your limits, like we do for people in Spartan Race, when they get a cold cup of coffee or the kids scream or maybe there's an extra baggage charge at the airport, they're not as upset because they say, well, it could be worse. I could be doing a Spartan Race.
And yet they come back for more.
And they do. It's very addictive, even though it's painful. And I've been there. I started doing lots of races in the 90s, and I found the same thing. In the middle of the race, I would say, what did I do? Why did I sign up for this? And as soon as you finish, I don't know if it's all the drugs that are released into your brain, the euphoria, but you get right back to the starting line. Want to do it again.
So as you mentioned, these are natural courses. You know, a lot of them are mountainous courses. You're sort of in the woods sometimes. Can you describe some of the obstacles and what people have to overcome physically to get through the course?
Sure. Well, we try to hit every pain point, right? So there's rope climbs, and that's very difficult for people to pull their body up a rope 20 feet over water. There's some swimming. Many people are nervous with swimming. There's fire to deal with. You're jumping over fire. That's a concern for many. There's crawling under barbed wire. There's climbing over walls. You name it, you're going to experience it. The only thing we require is that every obstacle is athletic in nature. We want this to be a sport. We'd love it to be in the Olympics someday. We think it's natural and makes a lot more sense than ping pong. So we'll see where it goes, but it's definitely caught people by storm.
And when you say you want every challenge, every obstacle to be athletic, you mean so people aren't going to be eating worms?
Yeah, that's for TV.
Yeah.
What we do is we want this to be a legitimate sport that everybody could participate in, where you're not going to find children sitting out on the bench because they might not be good at baseball or basketball, but everybody's good at this because we're human beings and we were meant to climb, crawl, run, jump, swim.
And yet it is a competition. People win, and people win monetary prizes. So do you just win by being fastest?
Well, it's not just fast. That's interesting because we bring in a lot of Olympians, ex-Olympians, national champions in running or triathlon, and no one seems to be able to beat our elite athletes that have trained specifically for this sport. And I think it's because you can be fast, but you've also got to be strong. You've also got to be very nimble. You've got to be flexible. And not many athletes, even the best of the best, have all those qualities. So so these elites that have been doing just Spartan races for 3 or 4 years are pretty much untouchable at this point.
And is there sort of a type that you can pinpoint? I mean, is it athletic prowess, big, strong upper body, so fitness, speed, mental toughness? I mean, I guess you have to have all three, but what's the
It's all
archetype?
Of it. We've been trying to find that. Is it a mountain biker because they've got tremendous cardiovascular conditioning? Is it a runner? Is it a CrossFitter that's doing lots of weight work? And it's really a combination. It's a unique individual. It might be a wrestler that happens to be a very fast runner that also happens to be able to lift a lot of weight. It could be one of our top females is a lawyer. she's a bankruptcy attorney, but she's untouchable. So you just don't know. It's just got to be the full package.
We're talking today about endurance and obstacle races with the founder of the Spartan Race, Joe DeSena. The World Championship Spartan Race is this weekend in Killington. And listeners, we'd love to know from you what motivates you to do this kind of racing, to do these kinds of courses. How do you train? How do you train emotionally and mentally to get prepared for this kind of thing? And what's it done for you in your life? Joe DeSena says it makes the rest of your life easier. You're not as likely to get ruffled by a small problem in your life like a cold cup of coffee. So is that true? Do you find that? Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. And we've been hearing from a lot of people this morning telling us about what motivates them to do this kind of racing. Alexis said, I, along with a stalwart crew of 4 friends, signed up for the inaugural Vermont Beast 3 years ago. We had never done any of the Spartan events, and they had never done a Beast before. We were all moms who were turning 40, and we figured this would be a memorable way to usher in the big 4-0. The race was the hardest thing any of us had ever done. We stuck together, and we made it through bloody and bruised, which sounds bad, but honestly, it was thrilling. I have done every Vermont Beast since, and I will be going back this Saturday. Joe, explain what the Beast is.
So the Beast is our most challenging course. It's a half marathon. It'll take the average person 5+ hours. It's probably worse than doing a full marathon out on the pavement. And that was inspirational to hear that they went out at 40 years old, toughest thing they'd ever done, and they keep going back. And that's what we see around the whole globe.
Do you see a lot of women competing in these races?
We are about 37% female right now. So if there's 1 million participants, that's 370,000 female will compete this year.
How do they do compared to the men?
Well, naturally, women just have less upper body strength. But I'll tell you, the elite women that I described earlier, most 99% of the men on the course could not keep up with. So I think they're pretty close.
We got a note as well from Michael in Lindenville who says, I've competed in Spartan races in the past. I really love the competition aspect, he says. I was a competitive runner in high school and college. After school, I still competed at a high level, training hard through my 20s and early 30s, running in road races and marathons. Now, 43, my body can't take the abuse of running a high number of weekly miles that it takes to remain fast. Obstacle racing has been a fun new way for me to compete. Obstacle race training has me doing a much more varied set of exercises. I do a lot of mountain running, trail running, and general fitness workouts. Hearing from a lot of people about the fitness aspects of this. Let's go to Stuart, who's calling in from Burlington. Hi, Stuart. Go ahead.
Hey. I wanted to call to recommend to listeners Joe's book. It's a wonderful story, and for anybody who's interested in inspiration, that's a good place to look. And the other comment I had was about Joe's races and the whole obstacle race kind of phenomenon that's exploded, and point out that, you know, there's an argument that could be made that obstacle racing in its current form is a local product because it originated in Pittsfield, Vermont with Joe and the team that he assembled down there. So,
Stuart, have you done this kind of racing?
Yeah. Joe and I have shared a few bowls of shredded steel for breakfast, so he probably knows who he's talking to.
It took me a second. I was about to say, when you recommended the book, that I did not know this person or set this up, but as I'm listening to you, I know exactly who this is. And yes, we've had a bunch of shredded steel for breakfast.
Stuart, thank you so much for calling in. I appreciate that. Stuart mentioned Joe's book. It's called Spartan Up, A Take No Prisoners Guide to Overcoming Obstacles and Achieving Peak Performance in Life. So go a little deeper into that, Joe. Where do you see this kind of mentality that these racers have helping in other aspects of life?
Well, so the problem is, and maybe many don't know that there is a problem, but we don't have rites of passage anymore. We don't go out and do hard things when we're growing up. And so we live in this, at least in this country, in this bubble-wrapped life where everything is very easy and accessible. And what that does is it throws you for a loop when things don't go well. And invariably, we all know things aren't going to go well through your whole life. I gave somebody an analogy today. I said it's almost as if we're driven in a Rolls-Royce with a chauffeur. In practicing life, but in real life, you know, you get thrown a Pinto, a 1972 Pinto, and it needs a flat that's fixed and things break down, and we don't know how to deal with that when it happens. And so Spartan Race gives you a taste for the worst, and it resets your frame of reference. So you say, oh my God, here's a great example. I was on a plane the other day, and they off-boarded everybody because the plane was broken. We got on a new plane. That plane was broken. Everybody got off, and bunch of the passengers were going crazy, and I just thought to myself, well, I could be doing the beast right now. It's not that bad. So it's important that we always have a proper frame of reference when we're viewing life on a daily basis.
But, I mean, you could get that kind of mentality as well from, I don't know, doing a lot of yoga maybe or practicing Zen Buddhism. Then you might not get as upset when the plane, you have to deplane and change planes. But you think something special about this kind of endurance and challenge?
I think so. I you know, it's going to sound self-serving, but I've done lots of yoga, lots of meditation, eat healthy foods. I grew up around a yogi, vegan. So I get it. But there's something about this that's different. I don't know if it's because the obstacles and metaphors for life. I don't know if it's because it's natural in a natural setting. But it is different. I've raced all kinds of events around the world. And there's something that happens here.
We're talking today about endurance and obstacle races. We're speaking with the founder of the Spartan Race, Joe DeSena. Let us know what motivates you to get down and dirty, what kind of mental training you need, what kind of physical training you need, and what it's been like for you to participate in these kinds of events. Lots of them going on around the country. We know a lot of you have been participating, so tell us about it. You can write to us by posting your note at vpr.net or call 1-800-639-2. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. I'm speaking today with Pittsfield resident Joe DeSena, founder of the Spartan Race. And we're hearing from many of you about why you get involved in obstacle races and endurance sports, why you push yourself to the limit physically and mentally. Give us a call with your thoughts at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your experiences on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Trish posted on Facebook saying, completing and training for the beast makes me, quote, an average mom, feel more like super mom. And Caitlin in Barrie says, I did my first Spartan sprint at Fenway Park a few years ago with my younger brother as a way to celebrate his 16th birthday and get a taste of what Spartan racing was all about. Spartan races are way more fun than I ever expected, and I have found myself really fired up to get other people involved in the work and play that leads to mental and physical empowerment. Life is short, go get muddy. And let's hear from Erica, who's calling in from Northfield. Hi, Erica.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
I just completed Muttarella 2 weeks ago, and as a not very in-shape, overweight person, I completed the race, and I got to say, it's just an amazing feeling to have completed it, and now I'm ready to start training maybe towards the Spartan.
Erica, that's very cool. You describe yourself as a not very in shape, overweight person, but to do an obstacle course like this, a race like that, takes a lot of commitment and hard work. So has it changed the way you think of yourself in any way?
It definitely gave me a lot more confidence. You know, I was nervous going in. The night before, I was really considering backing out, and I would approach an obstacle and think, oh, I can't do it, but I did it. And it's really just an amazing feeling to do more than you think you can. And it really does, I think, impact you outside of the race, you know, because now you know that you can do things that you didn't think you could do before.
Well, Erica, thank you so much for sharing that. Congratulations, Erica, competing in the Mudderella race. And, you know, lots of different kinds of these types of events being held around the country and around the world right now. Let's turn quickly to Adam LaRue, who's one of the founders of the O2X Summit Challenges. Hi, Adam.
Hey, Jane. How you doing?
Nice to talk with you. What's the O2X Summit Challenge all about?
So the O2X Summit Challenge, it was formed by... there's four of us, myself, Paul McCullough, Craig Coffey, and Gabriel Gomez. And Paul and I worked together in the SEAL teams for about 11 years. Spent a lot of time, and met Gabriel through Navy SEAL Foundation, which supports you know, families of fallen SEALs, and his close friend Craig. So, you know, the most important aspect I say here of O2X Summit Challenge is that, you know, we didn't necessarily go into it knowing that we were going to be in a national series of mountain races. Hmm. We knew that we as a team, we wanted to work together, most importantly, and knowing that, you know, just being together and really thinking about the type of company that we wanted to start. And we've all lived very active lifestyles. We wanted to have to be a socially responsible company, give back to the communities, giving back to you know, the environment, and most importantly, helping people push past their limits. So human performance is a key part of some of our races, and having people, providing them an experience to push past their limits, bringing fitness back to the original roots of the outdoors. Is what we're trying to do.
Adam, let me ask you this. We got a note from a call from Stuart a couple minutes ago, who was saying, you know, in some ways this is a kind of a homegrown kind of thing. We've got Joe DeSena, who's with us today from Pittsfield, who started this in Vermont. You're here as well. Do you see Vermonters as having a specific kind of bent that leads them towards this kind of event?
I think so. I think, we saw it this weekend up in Mount Ellen at the Sugar Bush Resort. I mean, I think you cannot have an appreciation for the environment, the beauty, and everything that Mother Nature has to offer. And then also understanding what, like, real rock scrambles are, what real natural terrain could do, and the type of challenges that Mother Nature throws at you. That's the unexpected. And I think Vermonters appreciate that fully.
That's Adam LaRue. He's one of the founders of the O2X Summit Challenges. Adam, thank you so much for calling in. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And we're talking as well with Joe DeSena, the CEO and founder of the Spartan Races. Joe, do you think that Vermonters have a particular, I don't want to call it a mental instability that leads them towards this kind of event, but what do you think it is?
I think Frank Sinatra had it wrong. Rather than New York, New York, it should have been Vermont, Vermont. If you could make it in Vermont, you can make it anywhere. It is a tough, rugged place. And, you know, going way back to the Spartan era, people that lived in tough, rugged places they were able to handle life that much better. And so, yeah, I think Vermont lends itself to this kind of thinking, and it would be a natural place for it to come from. So I think it makes perfect sense, and that's how it happened for us.
Well, we are hearing from a lot of Vermonters who agree with you. Jim in Shelburne emailed in to say, I'm 62 years old and will be running in my 7th Spartan race this Saturday at Killington, and I hope to complete my 2nd trifecta. When you get a little older, it's easy to start thinking in terms of your limitations, but I have learned from training for and competing in Spartan races that my only limits are the ones I place on myself. One of the best things about a Spartan race is how quickly the racers become a community. We help each other, cheer each other on, and celebrate success together. And then Lynn, Randy, Angela, and the rest of the New England Mud Junkies emailed to say, Spartan races have been the best thing that has happened to us. We're a group of mostly middle-aged men and women, three of us older than 50, known as the New England Mud Junkies. We've done races in New York City, Massachusetts, New Jersey, Killington, and Canada. We will be running a total of 6 races this year and recently earned our coveted trifecta. It is as physically demanding and even more so mentally challenging. Thank you, Joe, and see you at Killington this Saturday.
We'll see you there.
So explain what a trifecta is. We heard from both the Mud Junkies and from Jim about completing a trifecta.
So what we found, and I found personally when I raced, is when you actually put the Spartan race on your calendar, it forces you to start delaying gratification, wake up early, not hit the snooze button, start training, find yourself around friends that are going to motivate you. Maybe don't drink the extra glass of wine. But one race wasn't enough to really change your habits. And so we created the trifecta, which got people to do a sprint distance, 3+ miles, a super distance, 8+ miles, and then the beast, which is going to occur this weekend. And if you finished all three within a 12-month period, you earn the coveted trifecta. Now, what's interesting is we've tracked about 13,000 people have gotten tattoos, physical tattoos on their body, bragging about Spartan or this trifecta. So they take it seriously, and it does transform them. So the concept worked.
We're talking today about these kinds of challenges, athletic challenges, mental challenges that go into things like the Spartan races. We're talking with the Spartan race founder, Joe DeSena, who lives in Pittsfield. Spartan race world championship coming up this weekend in Killington. And we've heard from a lot of Vermonters already who are planning to compete this weekend. And a lot of you sharing your thoughts on why this has been important to your life. You can call with yours, 1-800-639-2211, or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Bill is calling in from Essex Junction. Hi, Bill. Go ahead.
Hi. I want to thank you, Joe, for what you brought for me. When I was 53 years old, I was working out sort of half-heartedly in the gym, like a lot of people my age do. And some people in my boot camp class did a Spartan race, and I thought to myself, I could never, ever do something like that. And then I thought, why can't I? Why can't I do something like that? So I spent a year training for it. Did my first beast a year ago in Killington. So my first race was the World Championship Beast. And came in the top 40%. And I'm going to be doing, I did on a couple weeks ago in New Jersey, I'm doing both the Beast and the Sprint next weekend. And I think what it's done for me is to really illustrate to me that my mind quits long before my body does.
Bill, that's so interesting. I'm going to stop you there because your phone line is really wonky. But Bill, really getting to the point there, he says, my mind quits before my body does. And this kind of training works both your mind and your body. What do you think about that, Joe?
Yeah, so you know, you had a Navy SEAL on earlier, and we've talked to lots of SEALs and Rangers and Delta Force, and as well as CEOs, and they all say the same exact thing, which is focus on the 3 or 4 feet in front of you. Don't focus on the fact that this is 13 miles. And so I love the fact that that gentleman that just called in was afraid, but then overcame it, signed up, and just dealt with it one bite at a time. And now he sounds superhuman, actually. So it works.
Let's go to Lydia calling in from Shelburne. Hi, Lydia.
Oh, hi. You know, I think this is fascinating. And I think there are a couple of pieces here. I totally get the part about the rites of passage. I've always thought ever since my kids were young that I really wished there were rites of passage that were built into our culture that really weren't. And that's one piece. The community that he's talking about, I think, is another. I think at large, if we blow this up to the bigger picture, I think so many of us are lost as Americans. We have such easy lives, and there's a sense of loss that, you know, that we don't have lovely, wonderful communities so much anymore. And so this intense community is really, really important. And then the third thing I wanted to say is that being outside is also really important. I think people just really crave this connection to nature that we really don't get on a daily basis.
Lydia, thanks for sharing your thoughts. Appreciate that. Joe, what about that? I mean, there is this sense sometimes in American culture that there's no rite of passage in that way. Lydia says, you know, that that's something that she wishes we had. Do you see this as that kind of thing?
Without a doubt. I mean, if I had my way, we would have a serious rite of passage in the U.S. For everybody. So super exciting for me to see, you know, a million participants doing this and really transforming themselves for the exact reasons that a rite of passage would do it. And then I think Lydia nailed it with just getting outside. How often do we get outside? Even myself now running this company, I've become an endurance typist. I sit and do 500-600 emails a day. And then you just feel alive when you go outside, even for a 10 or 15 minute run. So to do these, the beast this week and be out there for 5 hours, but then all the training that leads up to it forces you to just start acting human again. So I agree. And then the community is unparalleled. I'll give a quick funny story. I was in Chicago. I was putting on a workout, and there were 500 Spartans in uniform, Spartans t-shirts on, following me in formation. And I was screaming a chant, and they were responding with a roo, and the windows were reverberating, dogs were barking, car alarms were going off. And I accidentally bumped into a car. And the gentleman clearly wasn't a Spartan, and he had a bad day, and he started to yell at me because I didn't do any damage. I just bumped into the car. And when he saw that there were 500 Spartans, he got in the car and he drove away. So the community is very powerful.
We've gotten some comments from others about that as well. Christina in Pittsford said, it's all about the strangers that you meet on the course that help you over obstacles. You don't ever see them again, but you'll never forget them. And Avery said, one of these races is held at my partner's resort, Mountain Creek in New Jersey. And though I've never done the race, I've had the pleasure of being a bystander, and I'm amazed by the dedication of the racers and the dastardly difficulty of the obstacles. The most inspiring aspect of the race is the different fitness levels of the racers. It truly is an event for everybody. Hearing from a lot of people on that. Joe, you just mentioned, you know, you're inspired just by getting out for 10 or 15 minutes now because there's so much time that we all spend indoors. Do you still get to compete in any of these races?
I hate to say it, I'm getting soft. I am so busy with this business. I hadn't been home since June and it's no excuse. You know, I'm working out in hotel rooms. I'm a burpee junkie lately. I don't know if you know what a burpee is, mm-hmm. but it's the old squat thrust with a push-up thrown in. So I've been doing 300 burpees every morning to try to keep my fitness level up. But I just don't have the time for those big bike rides or runs that I used to. And quite honestly, it's unacceptable. But then what will happen is an email will come in and say, Joe, I just want to thank you. I used to play Xbox. I played 3,700 hours of Xbox. I traded it in for sneakers, and now I run Spartan races. And so it makes it all worth it. Even if that means I've got to live in front of a computer.
Well, so maybe you got to get rid of the company, sell it, and then you can just go be a competitor.
You know what? I don't know if we could do it because I think if it went off track and it was pushing the wrong foods to people or just didn't have the same core DNA that we developed, I think it would feel like a terrible sellout. So. Yes, it would be. That's a difficult decision.
We got a note about the company aspect of this. Rick emailed in to say, I just want to point out that the distinction that the Spartan races are for-profit races as opposed to the more common not-for-profit races and charitable races. Spartan races do pretty well financially, and I believe even charge for parking and for spectators at the Killington race. Mr. DeSena came up with a great idea and deserves to be paid for it. But participants should be aware that they'll be forking out a bit more cash to do one of these obstacle races. So how about that? I know you do donate in a lot of cases to charitable organizations, but this is a business.
Yeah, well, we're a really interesting for-profit organization. We have not had a profit yet in the 4 years since we've been in existence. But
still no profit. Close to a million racers and still no profit?
No, it's so expensive. It's actually, if you were going to get into business, in the race business, it would be the worst race business to get in because you're trying to build obstacles on the side of a mountain, bring out giant excavators, carpenters, et cetera. Think about remodeling a kitchen, how expensive that is and how it goes over budget. Try doing it on the side of a mountain for 10,000 participants. It's an absolute nightmare. And then when you try to grow as fast as we did and across the United States and around the world in 17 countries, that's got an enormous expense because in each market, you've got to let that country know you exist. So obviously, we think profits are coming someday, and we couldn't exist without them. And yes, it's expensive, but again, I raced for the last 20 years. Ironman charges $700. Our average ticket is $80. So it's really not that expensive. And the venues, not to pick on Killington because they're an awesome partner, but venues have gotten wind of the excitement that participants have in doing these events, and they charge a lot. And so you've got to pay that bill. You've got to pay, I think we have 500 paid volunteers at every event. So it's and I got to feed them.
Isn't that an oxymoron, paid volunteer?
Paid volunteer. No one really wants to volunteer.
Let's see if we can squeeze one more call in here. We've got Zishan calling in from Montreal. Go right ahead.
Hi. Actually headed to the border driving into Vermont from Montreal. So I had a quick question. I work out regularly. I get up at 4, go to the gym so I can do everything and my job. But I just cannot, for the life of me, kick myself in the butt hard enough to start doing Spartan races. I want to do it so badly, and before I used to use the excuse, oh, I've got plantar fasciitis, so I can't run, I can't do that. But now I got an insole custom made, and I'm going to be getting shoes that allow me to run outside. But just whenever I get to the Spartan page, about to click on doing an event, I don't know what it is. There's just something in me that doesn't let me go through with it. And I wanted to ask Joe, I mean, am I the only one that's feeling that? And if I'm not, or if I am, what advice could you give? Because it's one of those things that I want to do so badly, and I just can't bring myself to click.
Yeah, and you're talking here to the founder of the Spartan Race and the CEO of the company. So if he can't convince you, I don't know who can. But what about that? I mean, that motivation factor must be huge.
Well, a couple of things. One is I want you to email me, joe@spartan.com, because I want to really dig deep into what is stopping you from signing up. Two is, if you get a chance, check out a YouTube video. Admiral McRaven speaks at University of Texas, and he says, if you want to change the world, start by making your bed. And the point is, you just get up and you just start doing things, and that leads to something else. So I think you need to click on the button and just sign up. And if you don't have the money, I'm happy to comp an entry. But once you do that, watch what happens. Everything starts to change. You start training, you start put down the glass of wine, wake up earlier, find different friends, and you will get there and you'll finish it and you'll be on a radio show with us talking about how awesome it was. So just take the first step, shoot me an email.
Joe DeSena lives in Pittsfield. He's the CEO and founder of the Spartan Races. We'll put a link up at vpr.net so you can watch that video. You can find out how to email him, and you can see more information about the World Championships coming up this weekend at Killington. Joe's book is called Spartan Up, A Take No Prisoners Guide to Overcoming Obstacles and Achieving Peak Performance in Life. Joe, thank you so much. Good luck this weekend.
Thanks for having us.
Coming up, if warm water rises and cold water sinks, why doesn't Lake Champlain freeze from the bottom up? We'll find out coming up next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. On Vermont's west coast, we've got Lake Champlain, sometimes referred to as the Sixth Great Lake. And while it may seem pretty calm right now to the casual observer, lake scientists know that it is kicking up a storm. It's currently undergoing turnover and seiche as we speak. Here to explain exactly what that all means is Breck Bowden, director of the Lake Champlain Sea Grant Program. Breck, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thanks, Jane. I appreciate the invitation to chat with you today.
Let's start with turnover. So normally, if you're swimming around in a lake in the summertime, you'll probably notice that the water is warmer on top. You know, it's getting heated by the sun. It's next to the warm air. And then if you dive down to the bottom, the water feels a lot colder. Cold water is more dense than warm water generally, so that cold water is sinking. But during turnover, also sometimes called inversion, the warm water sinks. How's that happening?
So what's happening is that one of the most unusual and least known properties of water, actually. So you've set things up nicely. In the summer, we have the warmer water that's on the top. And just like warm air rises and cold air sinks, warm water rises and the colder water sinks. And that sets up a situation that lake scientists refer to as stratification. As the season progresses and we got cooler temperatures during the fall, those surface waters begin to cool down. And at some point, they reach a temperature that's more or less the same temperature as the bottom water. And at that point, there's no longer a density difference. And that's when we get this turnover of water that occurs. Now, as the water begins to cool further, it reaches a particular point. And at 39 degrees Fahrenheit, more or less, about 4 degrees centigrade, water undergoes a change that no other substance that we know of really undergoes, and that's that it, as the water begins to get cooler, it actually begins to get less dense. And so as a consequence, that cooler water, as it approaches the freezing point, begins to float. And finally, at the freezing point, when we create ice, it becomes considerably less dense, and we have the ice floating on the surface of the lake. If it weren't for that peculiarity in water, which we see in no other natural substance, lakes would freeze from the bottom, or they'd freeze solid, and life on Earth would be completely different.
It's so cool. I mean, that's just such an interesting thing, Breck. But do we know why that happens? Why this is a property of water only?
It's a property of what's called the hydrogen bond. So most people probably know that water is called H2O. It's made up of one molecule of oxygen and two molecules of hydrogen. And those hydrogens on different molecules interact with each other, and that interaction is temperature dependent. And so as it approaches this critical point at about 39 degrees Fahrenheit, that interaction begins to change. And literally what's happening is that the water is becoming more like a solid in that interval between 39 degrees and 32 degrees, where it finally does become a solid. Basically, the water molecules are kind of elbowing each other and making a little bit more room, and that makes it less dense, which causes it to float.
And is this happening right around now, or when are we going to see this?
The temperatures are, well, as we've seen in the last week, the temperatures have fallen considerably, but it will take a long time for the lake to cool off. There's a lot of what's called thermal mass in water. So even though our air temperatures are cooling quickly, the water will lag for some period of time. And so it will be deep into the fall, into November or December, before we start hitting that position.
So you mentioned that if we didn't have this property of water, life as we know it would not exist. Because, you know, in the wintertime, when lakes freeze over, there's non-frozen water at the bottom. And so things like, you know, aquatic life like turtle and turtles and fish can survive in the lake. So what happens to all of our aquatic lake and to things like algae at this time?
Well, those are good questions. And actually, some of the research that we're trying to do in the Vermont EPSCoR program on research on adaptation to climate change is focused on some of those questions, because while we know a lot about what's happening in lakes during the good portion of the year when it's warm and nice to be out on the lake.
Boy, that's a judgment.
We know a lot less, actually, about what's happening when lakes or embayments are frozen.
Hmm.
So the frozen conditions are creating conditions that allow life to exist. The bottom water in the lake is not getting too much below about this level of 39 degrees Fahrenheit or 4 degrees centigrade, and that's plenty warm enough for a lot of organisms to at least hang out until the next year, and they can access other parts of the lake again.
So we've been talking about this process called turnover and this really unique property of water, but there's another phenomenon that occurs on the lake called seiche. Can you explain that?
Sure. So a seiche is related to the activity, related to this stratification that's occurring in the lake. So if you imagine the lake as being this long, narrow cake that's kind of thick, and it's got two layers to it. The upper layer is the warmer water we've been talking about, and the lower layer is the colder water. And there's a layer of icing in between there that's this very rapid transition that you just described when we got on the phone of the warmer water going to the colder water. Now, if you've got that visualized, that layer of transition in temperature, which scientists refer to as a thermocline, a temperature gradient, is flat. Now, let's start blowing water down the length of my lake or down my cake. What's going to happen is that the air begins to drag the water with it. And as the water blows, if the water blows hard enough and long enough, it will actually pile some water up at the downwind end of the lake. And that's what we call a surface seiche. When the wind stops blowing, the water will rock back and forth from the higher level at one end of the lake to the lower end at the other end of the lake. And some very nice work done by Tom and Pat Manley at Middlebury College has demonstrated those phenomena. Now, the degree to which the water is piling up is actually fairly small. It may be only a few inches, and the rocking back and forth is on a period of about 4 hours or so. But something that we don't see going on is that as that water is being blown to the far end of the lake, it's actually piling up below, too. And so now what I'd like you to imagine is my layer cake with that middle icing layer tilted so that I basically have two wedges that are interlocking. I have the surface water that's warmer at the down end side of the lake, and the colder water that's thicker at the down end of the lake. When the wind stops blowing, that now begins to rock back and forth too. But there's two very different characteristics. One is that the excursion of that layer moving up and down is now on the order of tens of feet, upwards of 50 feet. And the water is moving at quite high velocities, many feet per hour, so that we can transport large quantities of water and large quantities of material that is dissolved in the water up and down the lake as this so-called internal seiche is going on.
Wow, this is so cool. Breck Bowden, I really want to thank you for giving us such a fascinating science lesson about what's happening in our lakes. Thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Jane.
Breck Bowden is the director of the Lake Champlain Sea Grant Program. Now for your messages. Managing producer Patty Daniels joins me to read some of your comments. Hi, Patty.
Hi, Jane. You know, we just completed three interviews with candidates running for governor of Vermont, incumbent Democrat Peter Shumlin, Republican challenger Scott Milne, and yesterday, Libertarian Dan Feliciano. We wanted to share some of your reactions to those interviews.
When I interviewed Republican Scott Milne last week, he used the word radical several times to describe Peter Shumlin's policies as governor.
And a listener named CJ wasn't impressed. He writes, "Is this use of radical code for being the first in the state to do something new? First to outlaw slavery, first in civil unions, first in legislated gay marriage, first to require GMO labeling? On which of these issues should Vermont not have gone first?"
On healthcare and how to change the way Vermont pays for and delivers it, our listener Jody also heard something that didn't sit well with her.
She writes, "As a medical professional, I, for one, am highly offended that you insinuate that by changing the way we pay for health care, that suddenly nurses and doctors will stop giving their all to deliver the care that they do every day. If that's truly how you feel, you obviously are unaware of what motivates health care workers. Let me be clear, it's not the money."
Friday in our interview series, we talked to incumbent Democrat Peter Shumlin. That interview also focused on the state health care exchange and how it might lead to a single-payer system.
Tom posted online, "I find Governor Shumlin's assumption that most Vermonters think the Affordable Care Act already is a single-payer system to be very condescending. He uses that assumption to deflect criticism of the terrible rollout of Vermont Health Connect. If the Shumlin administration can't handle this, how can Mr. Shumlin possibly be trusted to put in place an arguably more complex single-payer system?"
And on the topic of jobs and the economy, JN posted this comment online. "Fact, in Shumlin's term as governor, Vermont's unemployment rate has gone down. The total number of people employed is the same. State population is the same. So where does the remainder go? Have the unemployed just given up and signed up for social assistance?"
And rounding out the series, we spoke yesterday with Libertarian Dan Feliciano, who applied his philosophy of low government intervention to a lot of different policy issues. In response to that, Tiki says online, Dan Feliciano sounds like he would spend a lot of time encouraging, quote-unquote, companies to behave. But if faced with an environmental disaster or another financial meltdown, I dread having a governor who simply wags a finger at those responsible instead of enforcing the rule of law that we as a citizenry have taken generations to build.
During the interview, Feliciano talked about his daughter, who has autism, needing specialized education services and how that influenced his family's decisions on which school district to live in. Mark posted this reaction. Mr. Feliciano, how do you reconcile the need to conduct property tax reform and address the increasing spending on public education with the fact that your child is likely a high consumer of taxpayer dollars in public schools? As a libertarian, how do you ensure your child gets the services she needs while being mindful and respectful of the overall cost of education?
Well, there's a lot of interesting feedback on all three of those interviews. You can listen to them and read reaction at vpr.net/Vermont Edition.
You can also add your thoughts if you want to ask all the candidates a question. Send that question to vermontedition@vpr.net. We're going to have a debate for governor later this month. Thanks a lot, Patty.
You're welcome.
And that will do it for today's show. Tomorrow, we're going to talk to some reenactors about what motivates them to put themselves in the shoes of yesterday's soldiers, whether it's the Revolutionary War, Civil War, French and Indian War. A lot of them here in Vermont. We'll hear from them tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening today.